Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison and our April program, which will feature the panel here, the three of us reporting on the American Humanist Association 70th Anniversary Conference, the annual conference held this year in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They hold these conferences in different cities around the country, generally hosted by different humanist groups. Last year it was hosted by the humanist community in Palo Alto,
next year is New Orleans.
And held in San Jose, California. And next year it'll be in New Orleans. I'll just give a little bit of background information and then we'll start going through a selection of the speakers that we heard. You should all have received the email with links to the full conference program and to the American Humanist Association site. The American Humanist Association is the largest humanist organization in the U.S. with something like 20,000 members, and this conference was apparently the most successful annual conference to date with about 450 people attending. The first day started off with not much offered except a symposium sponsored by Essays in the Philosophy of Humanism, which is one of the groups within the AHA. And a lot of that was pretty dry stuff, but there was one exception, and Barbara's going to talk about that, by James Croft, who's affiliated with the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard University.
I can get my act together here. James Croft was just in this series of incredibly dry, academic sorts of presentations. Croft was just this breath of sunshine and the talk of the conference. He was a young man who is studying at Harvard and has been real associated with the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard with Greg Epstein. And he is a humanist celebrant, which is like sort of like a lay minister, I think, would be the equivalent. And feels through the work that he's done that humanism is too dry and needs to look at some more interesting roots. And he said he was greatly influenced by Star Trek, Sagan, and Shakespeare, as he counts as his mentors. And he had some wonderful visuals of various Star Trek programs, you know, which everybody would go, oh yeah, I remember that one. And pointed out that the Star Trek, the whole series, were basically based on humanist values. You know, the don't hurt any, you know, don't muck around with other cultures and respect the people that you meet and you know, that it's okay to be different. And just some wonderful philosophy that I had never thought about it as being a humanist series, but it, you know, clearly was when you think back onto some of the storylines. So he thinks that humanists need to have more stories, more music, more ritual. You know, sounded to me like I wanted to go up and say, have you been to a UU church lately? It seemed to me like that's a lot of what he was talking about. Very, very dynamic young man. We're going to hear a lot from this guy, I think.
What does he mean by ritual?
Well, I'm not exactly sure, but not ritual in the sense of, you know, bowing down and worshiping, but having lighting candles and doing music and various things, he said, that speak to people's heart instead of just their head. He was a choir boy in one of the cathedrals, you know, boy choir kid, and was powerfully moved by his participation in in the Church of England with, you know, the absolutely gorgeous music to be a part of. And that really spoke to him musically and emotionally, but didn't speak to him, you know, in terms of ethics and theology and stuff. So his idea is to take dry humanism and enrich it with some of that warmth that you get from more traditional music and that sort of thing. So he was by far the best speaker on Thursday, by head and shoulders.
Moving on to Friday, I'll just say a few words about the International Humanism concurrent session and then pass it on to Susan to talk about religion and the brain. Matt Cherry and Robert Johnson were the people talking about international humanism, and in particular about the International Humanist and Ethical Union. And they put out this newsletter, and anyone can borrow this if you like. It's usually distributed online, and if you get on their mailing list, you'll get it every month. I think it is monthly. Matt Cherry has been involved with humanism in a variety of roles over the years, and he's now working for the International Humanist and Ethical Union. And they're really the primary international humanist group, and are very involved with issues that come up at the United Nations, for example, attempts to make provide severe penalties for blasphemy of religion, for example. This keeps coming up at the United Nations, and the International Humanist and Ethical Union is always active in trying to prevent that kind of limitation on criticism of religion and that sort of thing. Robert Johnson, as past president of the Norwegian Humanist Association, which is one of the largest in the world, it turns out that there were, in Norway, there is a financial connection with the Lutheran Church, it's the official church, and that was challenged. Why should people have to spend their tax, why should they be taxed to support the Lutheran Church if they don't support that religion? And humanists got organized and got in on the deal, so that some of that money now goes to the people who affiliate themselves instead with the Norwegian Humanist Association, and they've got like 75,000 members, something like this. But that's all I'll have time to say about that, so I'll pass it on to Susan.
He did mention that the next International Humanist Ethical Association meeting is in Oslo in June, I think.
August. There's August. a little poster August. Over there about it if you want to go to Oslo.
Okay, I went to a lovely talk by Jane Holmes Bernstein. She's a neuropsychologist at the Harvard Medical School, Children's Harvard Medical School. She's definitely had a good sense of humor. One of the first things that pops up, her topic was religion and the brain, and one of the first things that popped up was, well, everybody likes pretty pictures, so she sold several different variations of pictures of the brain. Made everybody giggle. Her basic question, and not really a theory question, was, is religion really wired into the brain, or just like a fellow traveler? And her argument was that there's the four F's that drive the brains, plus the perpetuation of the species sort of thing, which is food, fight, flight, and friends. But so the social aspect of things. And she pointed out that the kids in Romanian orphanages who really didn't get any sort of friends sort of stuff have far more difficulty than other people. And she tied that in with the brain's pattern recognition plus the desire basically not to die, so that it's not really wired in the brain, but religion has driving forces in the brain, the desire to perpetuate yourself plus the desire not to die, which is sort of tied into each other, you know. You continue on by perpetuating your species sort of behavior. and the pattern recognition, so it just sort of makes religion far more accessible to people than it might not be. A very lovely talk.
What is pattern recognition have to do with that? I don't understand.
Pattern recognition?
What is religion?
Pattern recognition is you look at a pattern of anything and you sort of search for the meaning of it. You know, you look at those designs, modern art or anything, and you try to look for a meaning of it.
Find a pattern.
You know,
see a
like you see a cloud and somebody says it's a horse and somebody else says it's a pigeon, sort of thing.
Yeah, she says pattern recognition is sort of linked to language,
mm-hmm.
and that we are hardwired to search for meaning.
So
looking
be.
For those patterns of meaning in what we see, and that's how we kind of come up with religion as trying to find a meaning in experience.
So the pattern can be a series of experiences. Something happens, and then something else happens, and you try to make a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And the God of Thunder did this or whatever. Now,
there are these most superstitious pigeons who see patterns, but I wouldn't say that they have a search for meaning, right? They observe patterns in these random sequences.
Yeah, but because we have language and stuff, we overlay religion onto that. So. I went on Friday, I went to a talk by Margaret Downey, who, if the name strikes you as familiar, is the person who sued the Boy Scouts of America back in the 90s, where her son was rejected from the Boy Scouts because he came from a non-theistic home.
Oh, yes.
And so, yeah, so she sued the Boy Scouts. So that was kind of her humanist claim to fame, but she did a very wonderful program, and she called it Finding Your Aha Moments and Writing Your Personal Story. And so she went through a wonderful slide presentation as an example to show her personal story of starting out as a kid in the Catholic Church and gradually coming to her humanist beliefs and then her tackling the Boy Scouts and encouraged everybody to, and she had a little sheet that she handed out with a kind of an outline, encouraged everybody to write at least little bits about your background and kind of those aha moments, how you came to move from one set of ideas to another. So that was also a very good talk. Those two were probably my favorite on Friday.
How did
that suit come out?
They did not come out positively because the Boy Scouts then became a private rather than a public organization. I mean, they weren't allowed to sue to do what they were doing as a public. You know, everybody can join things, so they changed and made it a private organization.
Mm-hmm.
So they still legally can do that.
Also on Friday was a showing of The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today, which is a documentary about the McCollum Supreme Court case, Religion in Schools, brought by someone in Champaign, Illinois. And that documentary will be shown on public television stations around the country this month, and the director of the movie has a website where he's listing the dates, and there's nothing last time I looked for Madison yet, but hopefully that'll appear soon, and I would hope that we, several of us, can get together to watch that documentary together and have a chance to talk about it. It's very worthwhile seeing. And I met Daniel McCollum, who is the son of the woman who brought the case, one of her sons. And he has also written a book with a very similar title. And he said, you know, they could use the title for the movie. So if you go to the speaker speaker links on the Human Genome website. You'll have a link to his book under dental. Also on Friday was the afternoon plenary involved Elizabeth Cornwell and Richard Dawkins. And if Susan is ready, we could start with Elizabeth Cornwell.
I could just jump to Dawkins.
Do you want to go first?
Well, I just wanted to mention that she is the coordinator for Richard Dawkins' OUT campaign, where you literally say you're an atheist. So I liked one of the t-shirts, so I got it from my brother. It says on the front, "We are all Africans." And if you read it on the back, I don't know if anybody can read this, but it says, "The Bible says modern people are the result of incestuous relationships between Cain and his brothers had with their sisters. Science says we are all descendants of Africans." I believe science. And we had people modeling this. So RichardDawkins.net is trying to convince people to basically sort of, you know, based on the red letter A, like Hester Prynne's book, show themselves as all atheists.
Yeah. And she introduced Richard Dawkins, who happened to be sitting right in front of us.
Right. And he gave a relatively brief talk on metaphors and the strength of using metaphors and the caution of not overusing them or misusing metaphors, which are all the notes that I took, actually. So I was too busy listening to him. But I didn't think it was that strong of a talk.
It wasn't a very good argument because he uses metaphors himself. One of his favorite metaphors in The Blind Watchmaker is that you won't believe a tea tray in the sky. Not tea tray, teapot. So why should you believe a God up there watching over you? So,
do you remember what the baseball metaphor was that he was using? I can visualize it, but I can't remember what his point was.
No.
Please tell me it doesn't involve the infield fly rule.
I don't think it did.
He uses metaphors himself, so he was basically pushing and saying that religion uses far more metaphors, and so they should watch out and make sure their metaphors are actually accurate.
That they actually work.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, it wasn't the highlight of the conference.
No.
So.
No, Croft was much more a highlight for me than Dawkins.
Why don't you go on to the Rebecca Goldstein, one of the awardees.
Okay.
Humanist of the Year.
But she. She was a good speaker, and I thought, I am going to remember all this. And she had her book there for sale.
The title of the book is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction.
send it around.
Yeah, I think that book has gotten critical acclaim and is very well written and worth reading. It has a general appeal.
It's a novel.
I've definitely heard that. I have not seen the book yet, so I'm eager to see it when it comes around
the table. And I don't know if you heard Mary say that you've read it.
Yeah, I've read the book.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm.
And that she's written several others, too, which are on there. And
I wouldn't say it's the best written book I've ever read. It kind of rambles around a lot, but it sure covers a lot of territory. Very interesting, well worth reading.
Yeah, and she was a good speaker. She talked about her childhood again in a religious had a religious background and how she sort of grew out of that. Was just sure I would remember everything she said, and of course I don't, and I apologize because I didn't take good notes on her. Or if I did, I'm not finding them. So I have notes everywhere in very odd places.
Do we have this in our collection here at Prairie?
We don't, but that's mine, and you're welcome to borrow it.
May I, please?
You may.
Thank you.
You may.
My girl knows the untable.
Unless somebody snags it up first.
Probably a good one to have in the collection.
Yeah, well, I can donate it after I read it.
Well, you haven't read it yet?
I haven't read it yet. No, I just got it at the conference.
I'm guilty of feeling that she was rambling on and started nodding off myself, so.
Yeah, she did.
I can't help.
She did ramble a bit, yeah.
Well, let's move on to Saturday. The first thing I attended was the workshop on humanist chaplaincies and leadership on campus, and they added, and in the military, because they added Jason Torpy to their panel. Panel featured three humanist chaplains. Greg Epstein is the most well-known. He's the humanist chaplain at Harvard, and that's actually a position that's been in existence for many years, I think like 30 years, but it wasn't until Greg took on that position that it became a real organizing center on the Harvard campus for students. And the humanist chaplaincy now is a very active program of meetings and activities for non-religious students on the Harvard campus. And another chaplain is at Rutgers University, Barry Classell. He's an unpaid volunteer chaplain, humanist chaplain there, but he meets a need for students who aren't religious and yet have a need to talk to someone when there's a crisis in their life or something like this. So there are religious chaplains available, but this also provides a humanist chaplain. And the third humanist chaplain was the woman, Ann Clayson, who's the humanist chaplain at Adelphi University. Jason Torpy is the center of a group called Military Association of Atheists and Free Thinkers. And this is a group that is active in advocating for the rights of people in the military who don't want to be subjected to the kind of religious fundamentalism and things like the spiritual fitness check, which they put people through.
And needless to say, they flunk if you don't put the proper things down.
And there have been things like the Air Force Academy issues that have come up with promoting religion and pressuring people to be soldiers for Christ, basically.
And kill people better.
A quick historical footnote to all that. When I was in college, if you weren't a theist, you could not claim conscientious objection. Well, you could claim it, but they wouldn't honor it.
They wouldn't honor it, yeah.
No, but the Quakers are not all theists.
True.
If you were a member of a Quaker society, then you would qualify.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it helped.
Member of some group.
Yeah, it helped to be a Quaker or a Mennonite, I think, and it was almost exclusively granted, or draft affirmative was almost exclusively granted to those folks. But there was a relatively, I never went through it myself, but there was a relatively hostile cross-examination on that subject. And if they decided that you didn't believe in God, then claiming that you didn't want to kill people was irrelevant.
Yeah, and then there was a brief period there where even Quakers, they rejected everybody. There was a particular head of the thing that.
And that sort of segues into the talk I heard while these guys were going to the chaplain thing. I went to a biologist by the name of Judith Hand was talking about no more war and the human potential for peace. And one of the distinctly interesting things I remembered her talking about is that if you compare various species of apes that are closest, genetically speaking, to the human race, there are some which react very similar to us when you consider sort of the aggression war behavior, but there are some, like the bonobo apes.
Bonobos, yeah.
Which don't. And apparently they have equal genetic matches with the human race. So it could be argued that, biological speaking, you can have no argument for the existence of war. And she followed on from that, and it was quite an interesting talk.
Bonobos are the most closely related, I think. That's what I was told something like 5 years ago, but I don't know what
the basis, the source.
The current, well, you know, people have been doing more and more work on DNA since then.
Well, she only had a short time to talk, so she started with that sort of comparison, DNA. And I kind of went from there.
She has a website, A Future Without War, which I provided a link to, so if you want to see what
I mean, there were holes in her arguments, so I mean, one of the nicest things about it was afterwards, a bunch of us got together and started arguing the various holes and strengths and weaknesses of her arguments. So it led to a great deal of fun.
We also had the Humanist Awards luncheon that day, and the Humanist Heroine and the LBG Humanist Pride Award were awarded. Did you want to say anything about Judy Narcissian and
I was just going to say, if you know the Our Bodies Ourselves that came out 20, 30 years ago originally, she is working hard with her group to get it spread out throughout the world. Amusing thing that papers cost so much in Russia, for example, is that the only way they could get it printed was basically have it online. So the Russian ladies have to get it through the computer. And she can't remember all the other places that she was getting it printed out, but she's really trying to get it spread throughout the world with her group.
The Boston Woman's Collective.
Right.
Came out with that in the early
70s. Yeah,
Boston
Woman Health book collective.
Right.
Yeah.
What about Newt Gingrich's half-sister, Candace?
Yeah, this was the apparently the first year they decided to have a LGBT award. She was a decent speaker, and one of the interesting points came out is somebody asked her in sort of the question section, how to get basically the LGBT groups to work with the humanist groups, because they were thinking that they have a lot of common in getting people to get out and that sort of stuff. And she sort of pointed out that one of the problems the LGBT groups has is acceptance within the religions, so that she thought that it might, you know, it might be more difficult because you're basically not religious to get them to be interested in the humanists, because they're really working to get the religions to accept them. Yeah. And if they start going around saying they have no religion whatsoever, it would make it probably even more difficult to get the religions to accept the people to, with religion.
It's called a double whammy,
Which I thought was a very interesting point.
I think that's a good point. Yeah. If that's your bedfellows or atheists, then you're going to have more trouble getting your
lifestyle
accepted
throughout
society.
Yeah, since that Dawkins group is talking about going around with a red A for atheists, I mean, that's already a red flag.
Both need acceptance, but they don't need to be tied in the same package.
Yeah, exactly.
But she said, I mean, she did indicate she thought there was ways that you could, she didn't really define the ways, but she thought there would be ways to sort of get the guys to work together.
Oh, lots of ways.
Mm-hmm. Candace has published a book called The Accidental Activist, and the story behind that is that Newt Gingrich was always pretty accepting of her lesbian partner, until he started campaigning for office. And then he started coming out with all these anti-gay positions, and that really propelled her into becoming an activist in the
LGBT
movement.
She actually did go to one of the states that you can marry in, so she does call her partner her wife. And she's very emphatic about it, too.
Well, the next speaker that I was going to talk about is Professor Jay Wexler, and I think his was probably the most entertaining presentation of the conference. And this is his book, Holy Hullabaloos. He's a law professor with an interest in religion and the law, and he has tenure at Boston University, and once he got tenure, he said it just barely squeaked through, but the nice thing about getting tenure is then you can do anything you want. Mm-hmm. So he decided to tour these sites around the country where there was historical background for Supreme Court decisions.
Send that one around too.
And that's available from the library. He talked about Constitution breaking the First Amendment down into two primary parts, the free exercise of religion and the Establishment Clause. And then he cited a number of cases, such as the case in Florida involving animal sacrifice. There was a religious group that was actually sacrificing goats and other animals, and the city thought this was a bad policy, so they would make a law against it. And what they did was to pass a law against cruelty to animals, but then they filled it full of exceptions for everybody else except this church. And this was, I guess it was the Supreme Court, where they lost 9-0 because it was such a obvious discrimination against religion, the way they set the law up to prevent animal sacrifice but allow animal use for testing cosmetics and greyhound racing and all these other things. Another case he cited was the Wisconsin case involving Amish kids being prevented from going to public school. And you may remember when we had Sean Peters here, he had written a book about the Yoder case in southwestern Wisconsin.
Really amusing, because he went up there and he had a hard time finding Amish to talk to.
Right, there was only one guy left, he said, and they got a hold of him on his cell phone, and it turned out that he was home recovering from a motorcycle accident.
Not a very good representation of the Amish community.
When they got there, he was smoking and drinking soda. So he wasn't very Amish anymore. They talked to him about that case.
Had he gone to a public school?
I didn't say.
Well, wasn't that case that the Amish were pleading for the right not to send their children?
Right, they were keeping their kids home for religious reasons, and the school district was saying, well, you've got to send them to school, public school, until you're 15. And so that's where the case came through.
Well, they certainly set a framework for a lot of people who don't go to public school.
Right. And it was a precedent-setting case.
Yeah, the Amish only go to school through eighth grade. Yeah.
Their school's only comfortable.
So at that time, the court ruled in favor of the Amish, and then another case came along later which sort of changed that. I don't recall the details of that. Another case, school prayer. He pointed out that the court did not deny the right to pray in school, but it must be voluntary. So if there was some coercion to pray in public school, that was what the court was citing against. He talked about prayer at a football game, for example. In Santa Fe, they were routinely having prayer before each football game, and that was taken to court, and those who wanted to pray lost, but they were still allowed to have a moment of silence in lieu of prayer. And he went to one of these football games to see if they were actually not praying anymore at this location at the football game, and they weren't, but they were allowed to have a moment of silence, but when that point came along, they just went on to introducing the cheerleaders, and somebody yelled, "What about the moment of silence?" But he was ignored, and they went on, and the team lost 42-2. They never had a prayer, he said.
Oh.
I'd just like to insert that my mother was actually observer of Supreme Court on the day that the decision on public school prayer was announced. And she had all the details, and she spent many years of her life correcting people who kept saying that you can't pray in public schools.
Yeah.
There certainly are restrictions. You know, the teachers can't get up, and well, I'm not telling you, you've got to be there already. You know, but it was interesting to me that she actually saw it.
That's cool.
You also talked about the money going to religious schools, and how the voucher program was ruled to be legal as long as parents had the opportunity to choose a non-religious option for their voucher. And he talked to some Buddhists in the city and asked, well, could you set up a Buddhist school? And they said, we can't even get together on a picnic. There's so many different versions of Buddhism. And the amount which was set locally for, I think it was in Cleveland, maybe? Yeah. For that was approved for vouchers, just happened to be precisely the amount that you had to pay to go to Catholic school, and 90% of these vouchers went to Catholic school support. He also talked about government endorsement of religion, things like creches on courthouse lawn, Ten Commandments, a case where in Austin, Texas, Ten Commandments had been on the courthouse lawn for 40 years, and somebody, I think it was a homeless man walking past that, thought that didn't seem right, and ended up bringing a case. And the Wexler described the court's decision in this case as being as clear as a bowl of oatmeal, not very clear, just. But you know, I guess the idea was that because it had been there so long, it wasn't really a endorsement of religion.
Just as a quick aside, some of the worst written legal opinions come out of the U.S. Supreme Court. Lower appellate courts have to have what they write reviewed by higher courts. If you're looking for clarity in a U.S. Supreme Court decision, read the dissent. Those tend to be relatively well written. You don't have to cite the law. It doesn't have, you know, but some of Supreme Court decisions just are bad syntax, grammar.
You also mentioned that the fact that the U.S. Senate starts every day with a prayer was something that actually predated the Establishment Clause, so they didn't have to meet those requirements. He read part of a prayer that was used to start a Supreme Court session one day, a charismatic chaplain, and decided after hearing that this practice was more dangerous than he had thought. He also talked about public school curriculum questions, intelligent design in the schools in place of science. He talked about creation science, which he says was equivalent to creationism with graphs. He talked about his visit to the Creation Museum in Kentucky near Cincinnati. He thought that was a very interesting visit, that the way it was set up was well done from the perspective of what they were trying to get across. He went to the planetarium session where they use that as a critique of secular science in terms of questions on the age of creatures and the earth. They took the approach that, do you believe in human reason or God's word?
I heard someone on television who was evangelical, speaking to the evangelical crowd, and he said, well, who should I listen to, science, the scientists, or someone who was actually there? Meaning God.
Says who?
Those creation museums are apparently very expensive to get into.
Really?
Probably because they spend so much.
That makes God older than dirt.
I think it's like $25 to get in.
Created.
He also talked about
the praise, you know.
About teaching about religion in schools, which the courts have said is okay, but people are afraid to do that because it's too hard to draw the line between teaching about religion and teaching religion. People worry that they'll cross the line, and so they just avoid teaching about religion in schools as well. The book is available in the library if you want it. You probably also heard that Roy Zimmerman is coming to town. He's going to be performing at James Reed Congregation. He was the entertainment for the Humanist Awards banquet. He does satirical songs. I'll say a few words about Steve Wozniak, who was the Isaac Asimov Science Award recipient at the Humanist Awards banquet. You may recall he was a co-founder of Apple Computer with Steve Jobs. And he talked a lot about the early days of Apple and how he was more the engineer person, he was more the marketing person, and differences they had, and how he was sort of eased out of the company and still had shares and made him a multimillionaire, I guess. But he didn't say much about humanism.
He did have me positively drooling at his descriptions of the work ethics between employers and employees at Hewlett Packard. Got to remember, I'm a state employee, so I have all that junk going on. So there's this notion that the employees could use any of the equipment to work on their own projects as well as the projects they were doing for Hewlett Packard. Just, you know. The idea that somebody would treat employees with the notions that they have brains.
Respect.
Respect.
Yeah, it just made me drooling, you know, my seat. Yeah, give me.
He's written a book called I Was. And that's out now. The last person I want to talk about is Cecil Bothwell, who's probably the most interesting speaker in some ways. He was part of the final on Sunday, the panel, and that involved the man from the British Humanist Association and the man from the Secular Coalition for America. Did you want to talk about John Faircloth first?
John Faircloth was the executive director of the Secular Coalition for America. Speaks like a Southern Baptist preacher.
He was a politician, remember?
Yes, and he was very eloquent, persuasive, and like I said, kind of a combination of a politician and a Southern Baptist, you know, a real kind of y'all come and get on board, and so that was interesting in that sense that he was a. His presentation, I thought, or his style, I thought was so interesting. But he listed off all of the issues that the Secular Coalition is supporting. They had 10, what he considered 10 top issues. And they were all, you know, just so right on the target. So the audience was just very receptive to what he had to say, and they'll be working on those on a national level. The idea is to influence Congress to get those things that they want, to maintain the integrity of laws that way. But I can't remember what the 10 items were. Did you re-listen to his?
I did not re-listen.
We do have a recording of him, so which. Unfortunately, didn't have time to listen to it.
But it's available on the Humanist Union website if you want to listen to that. It's about 20 minutes.
Yeah, and he lists off all of these points. It was very, very stimulating. It wasn't the kind of thing that you nodded off during.
Neither was Andrew Copeson, which basically detailed the differences your humanists have in Britain versus in America.
Right.
And in one sense, they have it far easier.
Well, they have 120 representatives of the parliament.
The joke was Americans went over there and said, oh, we got one representative in Congress. And he goes, what? And they got
120. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in one respect, he has it considerably easier. But in another respect, I can't remember all the differences he has, but he has still a lot of work to go to getting total acceptance in Britain.
And one of the things that he said, the fact that the Lords, people who are peers of the realm still have automatic membership in the Parliament, in the House of Lords, and totally irrespective of any kind of qualifications. So that was one of the things that they were kind of working against in England.
Although there was a major change under Tony Blair, it's no longer entirely hereditary. They carried back the number of hereditary peers, and now they have lay peers who tend to be appointed for some affirmative reason. Being well connected, Yeah, I mean, that's still not exactly democratic, but neither is our Senate.
These were, with Cecil Boswell, were all part of a panel on the church-state plenary. Cecil Boswell was elected to the Asheville, North Carolina City Council, and he made international news because it turned out that North Carolina has a law on the books saying that you have to recognize the Supreme Being to be elected, to serve an elected office, and that he's an atheist and was known for that because of a book that he had written. He's the author of The Prince of War, Billy Graham's Crusade for a Holy Christian Empire. He got into that because of the Nixon tapes, where one of the tapes, Billy Graham was saying nasty things about the Jews, and when it hit the news, they put their spin machine in action and said, "Well, he doesn't remember saying that. That doesn't reflect how he really feels." This sort of thing. And Cecil Boswell was an investigative reporter at the time who figured there's probably more behind this story, and he got a hold of the transcript for this hour and a half conversation with Billy Graham with Richard Nixon, and it turned out that throughout this period, Billy Graham was talking about the problem of the Jews, and maybe when you get you reelected, we can do something about it, and how referring to them as satanic or something. Anyway, he found out that Billy Graham had been advocating for war and had done this not only with Richard Nixon, but with other presidents as well. Like, he wanted Eisenhower to invade French Indochina, which became Vietnam. Eisenhower didn't go along with that. He said that in North Carolina, the Republican Party was pushing for abstinence-only sex education. He mentioned that his father, who had been pretty right-wing all his life, ended up voting for Bill Clinton after he came down with Parkinson's because Clinton was in favor of stem cell research. He talked about football game prayers being ruled illegal and a Baptist church then coming up with a bumper sticker saying, "We still pray." And others in the area then came up with a bumper sticker saying, "We still read." And a group involved with the home chicken movement had its bumper sticker saying, "We still lay." He was feeling pretty positive about the growing strength of the secular movement in the Bible Belt of North Carolina. In his book on Billy Graham, he ended up saying that he thought he would be attacked as, he might well be attacked as Satan's helper for writing this book. So when he was attacked as a candidate for city council, he was described as being a self-professed Satan's helper. The primary election, he ended up first out of 10 candidates, and then in the runoff, he was third, but because there were three openings, he got onto the city council. And it was then that the controversy erupted over whether he could actually take this seat because he was an atheist. And that made the news internationally. And the attempt to bar him from the city council gave him a platform from which he has been speaking ever since. He's been invited as a speaker in various groups about religion and politics. And he's actually now a candidate for Congress from North Carolina.
Which would make him number two of avowed atheists or humanists.
He said that a number of elected officials have confided in him that they actually agree with him, but, quote, I could never say that in public. He's an active member of the Asheville UU Church, which has an atheist minister. And he's involved with an interfaith movement there for things such as domestic partnership, where he's found that he can make common cause with Mormons and Baptists who also support that law. And I talked about the Nixon tapes.
One of the home notes that he mentioned is that his hometown is one of the places FFRF has put their out-of-the-closet billboards and bus signs. And he did say that he personally thought they were rather neat. I don't know if you've seen any of the out-of-the-closet FFRF signs. They have just an average ordinary Joe, and they have a quote, and they say the person's name, age, and something about them.
The American Humanist Association has had a billboard campaign where they have a quote from the Bible, and then they have an alternative quote, humanist take on this issue, and something much more reasonable from our point of view.
Asheville is very close to where the Hare Mormons live, I believe. Mm-hmm. The interesting, when they're back here in May, if they have seen a lot of this, mm-hmm. I suspect they have.
Mm-hmm. They probably support them.
Baptist churches in the South are like storage lockers. I mean, all you got to do is put up a partition somehow, and because two different churches get formed, there are so many.
And the last speaker was Jeffrey Charlotte. And so we're going to be doing a whole thing, which we've asked Dolita if she would help on, because he was the one that wrote The Family.
And Street.
Right. Con Susan and Dale too.
Good. And that was just so interesting. We thought it deserved a whole session.
So I encourage people to listen to it. How long is it, Bobby? It's about an hour.
I think it's a little over an hour.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But his talk is on the website, so I'll listen to the talk, and we may do some kind of a summary of the talk, but then I'll try to work around that and bring in some other things as well.
Right. So both the talk and the book, his most recent book, can be. Yeah. Anybody can check out the book from the library and read it.
It's in C Street. That's the name of the book.
There are two books.
Right.
One is a book titled The Family, and then the other one is about C Street. I've not read C Street, but I've had reviews of both of them, and I think the first section of the book on the family gives a lot of the background, I think, that he probably keeps repeating, but...
Well, he covered some stuff in C Street regarding the Uganda and the effects on the homosexuals.
Yeah.
The family has helped with the stuff that's going on in Uganda. If you know the stuff that's going on in Uganda, especially with homosexuals.
Yeah.
The full name of the book is The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Can I see a show of hands of how many people here are members of the American Humanist Association besides?
Are we?
Oh, you guys too, eh?
So, one of the things that came out in the work, the roundtable for chapter leaders was that they're changing their from a 3 categories to 2 categories. You can now, they're only affiliates or chapters, and to be a chapter of the American Humanist Association, you have to have at least 5 members of your group who are members of the National American Humanist Association. We're an affiliate, and no one has been pushing us much to become a chapter, but if we ever wanted to, we have humanists in our name, and we would have to have at least 5 members.
And you have that, looks like
we do.
Technically, you count both families, you do have 5 members, so.
I guess we do if they count a family membership, the number of both people count.
And you know, if you ever do get interested in doing a lot of stuff, the AHA does have a lot of resources. I did attend a talk where you can get speakers to come and they give you grants and stuff like that, and ways to increase membership, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Any other questions?
I just wanted to raise the issue of the neuroscience. I think Susan, you mentioned that one of the talks you went to.
That was very interesting.
Yeah,
talk.
The question of the neuroscience to me, and the question of meaning, I think is such a key question, really, in this, especially young people who are, you know, on these campuses, and they have a better scientific education. And I think as neuroscience begins to become more widely known, its more recent implications, particularly with regard to religious instinct, I think that's worth exploring. And just another aside on the bonobos, I think historically, in evolutionary terms, the bonobos got hardwired when there was a lot of food for their usage, and they didn't have to be fighting one another for food like the chimpanzees. And so, although it's a wonderful thing, and I think they are the closest to us, if they don't have any soldiers, things would go very hard for those people that, when food runs out, don't have any soldiers.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting about the 2 talks that I almost like the best, with this Judith Hand and the neuroscience lady, is one of the most interesting things about it was, in both cases, there was enough questions brought up in everybody's mind that it was basically another half hour to an hour before people stopped talking about what they could think about with all the arguments. So
it was
almost like they were just starters for conversation.
Right. Yeah, whereas some of the ones in the first day of this kind of symposium, for example, they had one on Thoreau. And on Thoreau's Harvard address, which could be thrilling. It was the most boring talk I have ever heard in my life. And I was so frustrated because here this woman took what should have been just fascinating, interesting, exciting thing and did it like a college paper. Mm-hmm. It was just dreadful. Mm-hmm. And because it was so, and it was frustrating because I knew the stories and I knew how she could have done it and she didn't. And it was almost like, and it was also very male, that for very dry by and large and very male, and one felt like she was just kind of trying to compete with the hyper-intellectual competition. So that I found very discouraging. Whereas you got on past Thursday was a whole lot better.
You had a quixotic thing where, I think it was in the morning, she hears a talk which say beef is pretty bad for the country and you should stop eating a lot of beef. And then in the afternoon she goes to another talk which saying beef is pretty good to help you lose weight, so you should eat a lot of beef.
Yeah.
This is on that symposium, but only the first hour on Thursday was this the only thing you could go to. Other than that, there were other choices.
Which was a good thing.
There were problematic choices. That was one of where I heard about all the grants and stuff they can give you.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of stuff over there on the table if you're interested in seeing some of the literature that we picked up at the conference. And feel free to browse that.
And I would check the websites, especially if you like the neuroscientist. She left a whole lot of books for people to read. I wish you that was a good book for neuroscientists.
Oh yeah, I never got to pick up the list. I would have liked to have. Is it on the website?
The one children's book that Barbara bought.
Is that her list on the website?
Mm-hmm.
Was highly recommended by someone who said that she showed it to her 11-year-old.
She is a teacher.
Read it to her, and she said, "Now I finally understand what you do." This is someone who works really. It's called Humanism. What's that?
So thank you.